Good afternoon and welcome to this lecture. This lecture is organized by the Montesquieu Institute and the Europe Lecture Foundation. And the lecture is part of the Prinsjes Festival, a festival to celebrate democracy here in The Hague. The theme of this specific lecture is digital democracy. And I would like to give the floor to the moderator of this evening. Very pleased to have him here. Professor Media and Society of the University of Amsterdam, Rens Vliegenshart. Please, warm welcome.
And also a warm welcome on behalf of me. My role today is rather easy, and I'm also told not to talk too much because we have one lecture, but actually we have two lecturers, so you get two for the price of one. And both will discuss the very broad theme, democracy in the 21st century, and actually focusing on how many technological changes have changed ideas, maybe opportunities, maybe threats to democracy and in democratic society. And one of the big things is that there always seems to be a discussion between, on the one side, the ultimate opportunities that the new technologies actually give to politicians to communicate, to governments to reach their citizens, to voters to actually more actively participate in politics, and on the other hand, the threats that are coming with it. We talk about fake news. We talk about things that people call micro-targeting and might actually be not as good as you wish. And also, it might be reinforcing existing inequalities in society. And one of the big debates that take place within my own field, and I'm studying political communication, is the one between equalization and normalization. Is it just reinforcing existing power balances, or is it actually giving all those technological developments, actually giving opportunities to different actors, to maybe marginal actors in a society? These are just a couple of questions, very broad questions that I'm kind of bringing up, and I'm very happy that we have two speakers here. We're probably better able to address those and similar concerns than I am, and I'm going to give the floor first to Linnar Vik. He's an Estonian information technology entrepreneur and an IT visionary, and I was very curious what that actually was, but maybe he doesn't even know himself that. And he co-founded, and he's currently program director of smart governments at the E-Governance Academy. And Vik holds several international advisory functions, including a membership of the board on digital affairs at the European Institute for Innovation and Technology. We're very happy that you're here, and I'm going to give the floor to you. Thank you.
Excellencies, rectors, ladies and gentlemen, first of all, it's a great privilege to step into footsteps of previous speakers who have been in front of you holding the lecture on Europe and Europe's future. I'm trying to contribute also on my side on such an important topic as we face today, the interception of digital technologies with the way we build up our societies and govern the democratic processes. By education, I am information technology scientist and also economist. So, as was already reflected here, we have things with two hands. And I recall so much that whenever I have been advisor to government, they always have been wanted to have an one-handed economist advising them. But yes, we have also two hands, also with implication of digital technologies. What comes to the future, then it's most difficult to say. All we can say is that nobody has predicted the future with the digital technologies in the correct way. But what we see about the future, because it's very knowledge-intense industry, the digital technology industry, we see that emerging knowledge, which will be transferred into a technology, solution, services, and thereby also make an impact to our societies, is already emerging right now. Sometimes I try to make an analogy that future is like my hair. It's very little, and it's unequally distributed. In some areas, you can already see and grasp what is about the future, but in some areas, it's totally blank. So the future in our hands is very interesting, and I would like to start by going through a couple of things to put the digital technologies and country, public administration, government, and democracy into context. I have been advising now over 23 years government of Estonia on digital matters. It was not digital when we started. It was just to survive and how to use IT in the country which has just regained its independence. And IT was considered as a one tool to make public administration efficient and also to make a way ahead with local solutions, with local technological solutions, because we did not afford to maintain the public administration processes of the Western economies, and we did not afford to go with IT solutions, which were used and often invested to mainframe technologies in 1970s, 1980s by and Western European countries. So we started from the internet, from something which was freely available, which we were able to re-engineer to use for the purpose of public administration. And we were not so proud of that, because at that time, in early 1990s, internet was rather an technology to be used by geeks and by academicians, but never by governments who take themselves seriously. There are three cornerstones on which Estonian digital society is standing on, and they start with strong, secure digital identity for everybody. And this is something which we need to remind when we're looking around the world right now, good 25 years later. There are 4 billion people online every day. The mankind this year is using internet for 1 billion years. So 1 billion years online this year. And only roughly around 50 million of those 4 billion people have a secure, trusted digital identity. The rest of the world, we don't know who they are. Actually, we don't know who they are, or in better cases, we trust a third party we don't know or who is governed under the law of a different country. Despite that fact, people are online. And governments take very seriously, of course, to protect their citizens' rights in traditional brick-and-mortar world, with the borders and with water and sanitation and with order on street and making sure that everything works. However, that 1 billion years online which we spend as a mankind is out of governance of the governments, and this is something which we every day call up governments. You need to take a responsibility, and this is your government responsibility also, to protect the rights of your citizens and to enable similar identity as you provide them in everyday life, also in the digital sphere. The trusted digital identity has a number of impacts, and it's not just about transactions and cost of digital transactions, which are much more efficient, cheaper, and faster compared to traditional bureaucracy or paper-based transactions. It's the fact right now that only one small aspect, the fact that people in Estonia sign documents digitally within the government and private citizen to a business, and between the citizens, different contracts and transactions, saves roughly one working week per year for everybody. And this is only just by using digital signature. This is 2% of the working time of people. 2% of the all working weeks you have per year. And if that can be used for something meaningful instead of standing up in the queues for your municipality or your government, or doing something on paper with your utility provider or bank, it's already a big winning. And I would like to remind you once again, innovation and new technologies are not delivered to us by container ships from some other country, but innovation is made by us ourselves every day in small pieces. Small steps every day matter more. And this is why, for example, a small thing like digital signature that is trusted and used in society can benefit you in so many different ways. And it ends up also, in Estonian case, with being an ultimate legislative power to take part in the municipal, parliamentary and European elections every time they are coming. Of course, the second part on which Estonian digital society is standing is the fact that we have been working very hard to deliver and make sure that everybody has an access to technologies and knows how to use it. And this is not entirely at all the role of government, because majority of efforts made to deliver digital access and to take society outside of education systems through the training programs has been made by private initiatives, where telcos, banks, IT companies, utility companies form a non-profit foundation which already more than 10 years ago addressed blue collars of society and within 6 months trained 20% of employment market free of charge during their working hours, which employers gave a free time to learn how to use IT and internet, not even if they don't need to use it during their office or daily work. But employers recognize that this is something which makes benefit for their people. It's so logical that if a person comes to me and says that I need to go and go to municipality and sign up my daughter for kindergarten, you say that, well, this is computer is here. Sign up here. It's free of charge for you to use the computer. You don't need to go somewhere to do it. And this is a benefit also for the businesses. So the internet access as a human right delivered to you via public internet access points, via free Wi-Fi stations around the country, is something which we worked very hard in late 1990s. And the third pillar on that is a transparent and efficient public administration, e-government, government and parliament. Estonians trust in politicians and trust in the government is pretty much similar like all around the Europe. However, the trust in e-government is around 90-95%. It's the same system, it's the same government, but it's a different form. So people prefer a form which is for them more convenient, more usable and easier to access compared to the regular traditional channels to go somewhere. And the top of the iceberg, how cabinet of ministers work, was redesigned in 2001, when we recognized that only place where the papers are used in Estonia still is a cabinet meeting. And the rest, of course, was used already on computers and in digital environment. So Prime Minister called me up and said, can we do something about it? Is there a new idea? Has somebody else done it before? I said, no, I don't know. It was middle of the year. It was summertime. everybody was on the vacation, and there was no budget available, and I went to State Secretary and asked, what is the cost of copying the papers for cabinet meeting? And can you give that money to me? I will guarantee that you don't need to copy any longer papers in 3 months' time. And in less than 12 months' period, just by copying the paper's budget saving, the system made a return back. It also created something which we did not recognize when we made that system working. The cabinet agenda is public for society, for everybody, 1 week before the meeting, including all the positions of all the ministries, including also the background documents. And the moment the decision is made by cabinet, it's also public online. So the lag is somewhere between 10 to 15 seconds between the decision is made and it's available and informed to public. So we wanted to narrow and gap and make the breach between society and government, and to make understandable how government works, what are the internal processes, what is in the agenda, how the decisions are made, to make government more accountable, but also to make society more understand how the government is functioning and working. It was not only that. The more important aspect, actually, which we recognized at that moment, became with a good old saying that you can't preach if you don't practice. Governments around the world have been preaching their citizens and businesses to be innovative, to use new technologies, to go to the breakthrough and invent something new. And in the same time say, yeah, everybody can be innovative, except we, government. So we recognize that government needs also not only to preach, but also to practice. And that is an ultimate litmus test, whether people trust your policy, which is innovation intense or not. That was so many years ago that we don't even remember it anymore. Nobody talks. And this was a historic video from that very week when the system was created and introduced. Right now, the institution where I work as a co-founder and program director has been advising and helping governments around the world on their digital efforts. And we can say that all countries around the world have more or less coherent approach to the digital technologies, and they have their digital agenda. Yes, it's sectorial based. There are some areas, especially public administration, management, customs, state treasury, border guards, immigration-related matters and issues, document management, which are very intense. But broadening to the education system, broadening also to healthcare system, and we see there is a hunger. Right now, 95% of all digital wallets used worldwide are used in Africa. When we skipped checks in banking in Estonia, then African countries are skipping banks in banking. And the digital wallets in use have a very, very interesting use cases also for micro-entrepreneurship, for the way how people create at least a minimum wealth for them and sustain their levels of making money on their daily lives. And it's also in the same time very interesting to see what is the approach of countries to participatory democracy and how they address what can be done with the help of ICT, not to make government work as an efficient machinery, just automating the processes and making them digital, but how to reach people, how to engage people. This is something where majority of governments has failed. Yes, we are witnessing around the world very interesting bottom-up, grassroots-level initiatives, NGOs mostly, delivering cross-border services engaging to the globally important issues. We have a number of municipalities, cities around the world, which are exploring the participatory budgeting opportunities, also in smaller communities, exercising the ways how community can participate in council meetings, how can impact really decision-making on the council level, not just an administrative, everyday public administration and bureaucracy. But they are mostly bottom-up and very small initiatives. On a central government level, the kind of top-down engagement, invitation to join, we have on a broader scale failed. And what comes to the political debate and political fights around the different governments and election period especially, we have seen that nobody is interested in using digital technologies as a fair playing ground for enhancing democratic debate. It's rather to hit more each other. In the same time, society has changed. In less than a decade, something happened which nobody predicted. It's a famous picture, of course. You recognize a place and location. People are on the same event, waiting the white smoke to appear from the chimneys of the Vatican. And yet something has changed. People are waking up with the digital technologies, and as I said, they are spending 1 billion year this year online. Over 10% of all electrical energy we are using is globally going already to keep up the internet and telecommunication and data centers infrastructure, and it's penetrating all the spheres of our lives. It's changing digital technologies, industry after industry, and sector after sector, and 1.3 trillion euro worth of the global public administration and governance sector is most probably the one who will get next the way how they will be disrupted. In the same time, there is also, from the information technology and digital technologies point of view, a very, very interesting and very challenging point we are going through. We have learned how to capture digital information. We are very good at capturing the data, and it's growing exponentially. We can say already that in 1 month's time, we capture as much data as all mankind did until year 2010. And it's still growing exponentially. It's no longer the tweets we are tweeting by far away. It's machines which are talking to each other. It's networks which are talking to each other. And this is data generated by machines which can be used to make our lives better. But we miss and have a gap in analysis. We only learn, and our learning curve, how to use that data, is not growing exponentially, but rather linearly. We make some milestones and jumping steps, but they are rather steps, not as really going to the next generation of levels. And this is something which we need to follow. And one thing which we have learned, especially in Estonia, don't delete your data if you want to make a value of that. The time series we are working through, let's make one example. We have in Estonia National Genome Project, where people, population, genomic sample, DNA, is sequenced and used for the population health. When we sequenced that data, we started with a project 2008. When we sequenced that time, we had this much of value. When we sequenced it 5 years ago, we had this much of value. And now we are taking the same sample to sequence it again. And what we have learned within the 10 years can make broader value to society than we could ever imagine 10 years ago. So the data series we are storing and analyzing yet again with the new technologies, with the new methods, give us better and better values over the years. That takes me back to the topic of state of the present of democracies. A couple of days ago, the University of Gothenburg published the yet another state of the liberal democracies around the world. And there were not too many positive messages. The rise of authoritarian democracies is in the race. The populist segments within the debate are overwhelmingly shadowing the traditional argumented debate in the political sphere. And when we look to the top ranking of the countries with a liberal democracy index, it's countries which we would say are mostly an old democracies with long traditions and long habits in that area, with some exceptions. We are very surprised. Well, we never did in Estonia things for the sake of rankings, but we were very surprised that we are the only new democracy, if we might say so. Coming from the former Soviet Union, we just are learning the steps of democracy that we are ranking so high. And why we are ranking so high is the fact that we are only learning how to use digital technologies for the sake of democracy, despite the fact that we are not satisfied at all with what government is doing to engage people, to build up really truly the participatory democracy. We are still heading in a number of areas the way how we're using digital democracies to make democracy sounder. The second area which we are not proud of, often when we look at democracy, then we look also how free is the use of internet around the world. The freedom on the net is showing us the decline. Already third year in a row, we are having a decline in a global freedom on the net. And this reflects something. In the early days, say in 1990s, government used internet and digital technologies for internal public administration efficiency and also for the enterprise communication. Then they started to spread it also to the society with a certain levels. And when they realized that people have a powerful tool in their hands, they started to block it. The blocking technologies can be very, very different. There is a vast amount of varieties how you can use it. This is a famous picture from the manifestation in Moscow where people continuously find that the websites they are trying to use and access, which were just available yesterday, are no longer existing. And the information which they were just looking at has disappeared. Those are rather complex technologies, and we are not talking about some other authoritarian countries like China, but there are very simple technologies to shut down the online debate, the bloggers, the investigative journalists. It's enough when you take a bat and three guys, you beat publicly up a journalist or blogger, and it's for sure. For next 6 months, nobody is no longer blogging against your government. Most commonly used technology is something which dates back to the Neanderthal times when they were mating up with human beings of our present. So those technologies work very well even nowadays. So we see that governments who have a control now and more control and awareness around about the information communication technologies are rather using that technology to stop. And the first reaction for the governments is how to stop people using this or that. How to make people stop using Uber. How to close down Airbnb. How to stop YouTube. How to stop blogging. how to make sure that Google is giving only the answers which we like Google to give. And those are the big questions which often governments are having right now. In the same time, we started with an internet voting in 2005. And it's based, first of all, on the strong digital identity provided by the government and trusted by all parties, including all the members of society. All the banks are trusting utility companies, and society, in a broad sense, is trusting that technology. Because the security level was as high as possible when we introduced it. We are also able to exercise the kind of ultimate exercise, which is voting on the elections. People working in the field of technology will be thrilled because you need to secure the authentication in one hand and anonymity in another hand, and then you have third hand, which is session security, and you have to have also a very strong encrypting, decrypting processes, and this is brilliant technical wet dream for any engineer in the field of computer systems, information systems and security. In 2005, when we started with that, we did not know where it goes. We started because we could. And right now, we can't dream that our next election, the 10th ones in Estonia, which will be held also by using internet, will be without it. In next March, I predict that in the last elections, over 30% of all the votes casted were online. I predict that it will be getting closer to 40%, and we have also a number of worries. We have a number of worries because of the digital inclusion, especially in the elections. We are not worried because of elderly people. They are very active voting online. We are most worried about the age group 18 to 30 who don't participate, whatever is a channel for participating in the elections, because politics don't talk to them. Politics don't address them. They don't want, they don't feel, and they don't feel a need or obligation to participate in the elections, whatever is a channel. And this is a big challenge for us, how to address that generation who for sure knows already they will never go to pension in their life because we have made the national economies functioning in the way where they are. Environment is worse off than we had. Economy is worse off. They will never have a pension. They will not have an employment and job market security as the previous generations had. And they see politicians never speaking about issues what really matter to them. Our politicians made a nice Facebook campaigns where they had the same stupid photos from the photo sessions with vote me. In the best case, it was redesigned into memes by young people, which did not turn out into a voting. So despite the growth in general participation in the election by using internet and online channels, we are still facing a number of challenges, and they are not security challenges. They are challenges for parliamentary democracy as we have it. And I would like to conclude my presentation by re-quoting Melvin Kranzberg, a good old American technology historian, who stated very wisely at that time that technology is neither good or bad, but most importantly, it's nor neutral. Every country, every society has a very unique digital roadmap to go. They start from the technology perspective, maybe from the same place, but social, cultural, regulatory, public administration, bureaucracy, institutional issues are different. Sometimes even religious issues are the ones which stop or escalate some new movements in society. But what we see when we're looking the use and digital adoption rates from the business sector, then the business sector, which is reflected here with a green line, is slower in terms of GDP to go for digital. In the countries where GDP is over 10,000 euros per capita, the digital adoption rate of the businesses starts to escalate. In the poorer economies, they are waiting. They can manage in a different way without going digital, without making technology investments. The red line represents individual use. And what we see, we are witnessing right now the hyper-growth of internet use for the private users in South Asia, in Africa. There are 450 million internet users in Africa, and it's going to double in 2 years' time. And that adoption rate for the individual users is fueled by the value they get from the digital technologies. And thirdly, when we look to the governments, where are governments in that picture? They are all around. This is once again the proof for us. Money does not matter when you want to make your society digital, lead a digital transformation, and be, as a government, the one who is using digital technologies. It's about political will. It's about willingness to go for the technological changes. And most importantly, it's also the way how you engage your society on your digital footprints. I don't know really what the future is bringing, but I'm so glad to live together with you in the most interesting time, when we see different sectors being impacted by innovation, by new technologies, where we see that in most cases, when used wisely, they are making our lives better off every day. And I'm most happy to see, together with you, that our governments will also be not just forced, but will be most probably during the upcoming years really challenged happily to use digital technologies, and not just to make governments efficient engines, but to make also societies based on the participatory democracy and stronger digital engagement. Thank you so much once again, and it was a privilege to speak in front of you.
Thank you, Lina, for this very engaging and very clear lecture. I liked how easily you moved from the small, relatively small examples in Estonia to the big global challenges that are facing us, and also how they are actually connected, and how small things can actually make a difference, while also realizing that indeed technology is not a panacea, a solution for all kind of larger problems or challenges that our current democracies are actually facing. So thanks for that. I can imagine that there are a lot of questions to Lina, but we have to wait, as I've been told by the organizers, until after the second lecture. And I promise you that one will be worth listening to as well, because it will be given by Professor Mireille Hildebrand. And she's a research professor on interfacing law and technology at the Vrije Universiteit Brussels. Are you allowed to say free university? We're not allowed to say that in a Dutch case, actually. When we talk about Free University Amsterdam, that's always incorrect. And she's appointed by the VUB Research Council, and she also holds the part-time chair of Smart Environments, Data Protection, and the Rule of Law in the Faculty of Science at Radboud University Nijmegen. So I'm going to give the floor to you. Great that you're here, and we're looking forward to your lecture.
Thank you very much. I can immediately skip the first two slides. Apart from the title, I forget. And of course, I want to say that I'm delighted and honored to speak here, and I'm very curious about all the questions that we're going to have. So I want to speak about democracy. And I want to speak about democracy as action, and I'm going to explain what I mean with that. And in the subtitle, you see the contradiction. We're in the area of behavioral targeting. And I hope that at the end of my talk, you have some sensitivity to the difference between action and behavior. So this is a nice quote that I'm going to read to you, and it says, "We must not believe that democratic conditions automatically maintain themselves, or that they can be identified with fulfillment of prescriptions laid down in the Constitution. Beliefs of this sort merely divert attention from what is going on. Just as the patter of the prestidigitator enables him to do things that are not noticed by those whom he is engaged in fooling. For what is actually going on may be the formation of conditions that are hostile to any kind of democratic liberties." Who knows what the word prestidigitator means? I didn't. Ah, you looked it up. So prestidigitator, presti is fast, digit is fingers. It's simply an English word for magician. So somebody who's very fast with his fingers and can take an apple from your ear and you never noticed how he did it. And it seems to be that we like to pay people for fooling us. We like to go to magicians and we enjoy it. But this is, of course, something said where the fact that you are being taken for a ride and fooled is not positive. And what whoever is speaking here is saying is that we cannot depend on some rules that are somewhere. We need vigilance, we need action, we need habits to consolidate a certain attitude. Now, this could have been said today, but it was actually said in 1939, which is, of course, a memorable year, by John Dewey, the American philosopher, and who wrote a lot about democracy. And I want to now ask the question, who are today the new prestidigitators, which is a lovely word because we see digital again. Who are the new prestidigitators? And I'm going to claim that political micro-targeting is a type of magic. It is built on commercial advertising, and I hope to convince you of that in the rest of my talk, where digitalization and computation, because the back end of these systems are a matter of computation, complex computation, is used to fool both advertisers, the industry that want to sell something, a product or a service, and consumers, because they are basically paying for this, maybe the publishers. My claim is that this does not work as professed. Micro-targeting doesn't work. Maybe a little bit, yes, sure, maybe in the short term, maybe for some groups. But generally, it doesn't work. However, it does work in the sense that all the people that believe in it, believe that it works, the advertisers, maybe the consumers, the publishers, base decisions on it. And in that sense, it works. Now, by the end of this talk, on my last slide, if we ever get there, if I'm fast enough, that's why I'm giving it to you now already, I'm going to propose four ways by way of solution direction. These are not things we can just solve, that's clear, but we need directions how to think about these things. And I think the first thing we have to ask ourselves with any offer to buy into literally by governments, for instance, into applications of machine learning, and I'm purposely avoiding the term artificial intelligence. I think our intelligence is artificial. Let's not go into whether these applications are either intelligence. They are definitely artificial, but there's nothing wrong with that. The first question we have to ask is, do we want to use it? What is the advantage? What problem does it solve? What problem does it not solve? And which problems is it creating? The second thing is a concept that I developed called agonistic machine learning that is inviting the people who suffer or enjoy the consequences of these applications to join in the design of these systems. I'll come back to that on the last slide. The third is data protection law. Why? Because micro-targeting is built on the use of our behavioral data. And I think that's very problematic for a whole number of reasons. Not just because we want to protect privacy, but because some of the things we do with this data leads to crappy applications that are not reliable. And a lot of money goes there. And the last one is competition law. And I'll come back to that also in the last slide. This is, of course, about the fact that most of these behavioral data are now concentrated in the hands of a few companies. So what we want is transparency, participation, and contestation. And I'm going to give you a quote of myself of a shameless, something that's going to be published next year, where I say, but it's already online, that's how it works, you put it up at one of these wonderful sites, where I'm saying agonistic machine learning refers to the design stage of machine learning, requiring that we build adversariality and democratic participation into the makings of our new world, because these systems are actually reconfiguring our world. I want to speak briefly about how we look at democracy. And I want to spend most of the time talking about political micro-targeting, and I will end with, I think, two slides on how we have to reenact democracy and the role of law. What is the role of law, and can we have the rule of law? So let's start with Hannah Arendt. Hannah Arendt in The Human Condition made some very interesting conceptual distinctions between labor, that's something you have to do, it's very biological, it's repetitive, it's life-sustaining, it's very important, but it comes back all the time. Like, let's be very banal, washing the dishes. You can do it, it's not that tomorrow you don't have to do it. Work. Work is what is really artificial, what we're very good at, producing artifacts, things, washing machines, but also our institutions, the state, the judiciary, all sorts of parts of the government, education, universities, institutions. They are artificial constructions that we have made. Whole of society is that in the end. The third is action, and action is different. It's about speech. It's ephemeral. When I talk, 1 minute later, 1 nanosecond after I use my voice, it's gone. So speech is something very different. It's about what Hannah Arendt called natality, new things. Like she writes, there is mortality, we die, and there is natality. And she writes somewhere something that actually one of the founding fathers of artificial intelligence, cybernetics, Herbert Simon said that it's a very good thing that we die when we are old, because then we're filled with bugs. We have too many legacy problems. And it's very good that this is wiped out and totally new systems arise. This is our kids. Might be a depressive way of looking at it, or not at all, but there is a very clear link between Hannah Arendt and Herbert Simon. Bien étonné de se trouver ensemble, of course. At the end of The Human Condition, she makes a very interesting statement. She says, the trouble with modern theories of behaviorism is not that they are wrong, but that they could become true. And I can talk about what this means for an hour. I'm not going to do it. I hope you sense what this could mean, what she means with it. She said that quite some time ago, long before we have all these behavioral data. It's like as if she was a prophet. She was talking about then, but it's now happening. When you look into how machine learning works, then the assumption, if you're using machine learning to describe or predict human behavior, clickstream behavior, mobility behavior, location mobility behavior, gait behavior, how I move my hand and how that correlates with the onset of Parkinson. The assumption is that this description and prediction can be done based on a mathematical target function that underlies reality. So, very practically speaking, machine learning is, in a sense, very Platonist. Reality is mathematical. And if we can get our hands on those mathematical laws, we know everything. There was a nice conversation on the internet between Dawkins and Mark Zuckerberg. If you get very famous, you can talk with each other on the internet. And Dawkins asked Zuckerberg, what makes you tick? What do you really want to know? And then Zuckerberg said, well, I want to know whether there is a fundamental mathematical law that underlies human behavior. And then he waited a bit and he said, I bet there is. So anybody who thinks that Zuckerberg is after a lot of money, I don't think so. He already has that. He's after getting all these behavioral data because that way he thinks he can get his hands on that fundamental law. And this is not theory. This is what is happening now, today. Even if it's not true, it's still happening because all these decisions are based on it. Very quickly, about democratic theory. There are three ways of looking at what a democracy is. The first one we all know. Representation, one person, one vote. This is based, according to some people, on the idea that you can aggregate given political preferences, voting behaviors. You can aggregate that and then say, oh, well, the majority wants this. There's another way of looking at it. They don't necessarily bite each other, but the second one is very important. If we lose that, we're not good. This is the idea that every person in the polity should be treated with equal respect and concern by its government. So it's not because you pay more taxes. It's not because you manage to pay less taxes because you're extremely rich or very poor, or because you're very clever, have all sorts of degrees, that you can vote. You might be very stupid or very intelligent, but everybody gets to vote. Second way of looking at democracy, because just this voting, we all feel that's not enough. That doesn't define democracy, is the idea of public reason, public space, deliberation. Famous work of Habermas, from which he wrote in the 60s, actually, very empirical work, where he talks about the private public sphere, newspapers, magazines, and he was then being skeptical about the mass media. But now, of course, we have search engines and social networks that determine the sort of discussion, deliberation that we have in the private public sphere. And there is the public sphere, parliament, where decisions are made. And the idea is that if we reason about the public interest, about the general interest, if we reason about it and think really well as rational persons, then we'll come to the same answer. There will be consensus. That's the idea behind deliberative theories of democracy. Of course, it's clear that this doesn't work. I'm not saying that it doesn't work at all, but I'm saying that we are confronted all the time with resistance, with people that do not understand each other, with reasonings that are sort of incompatible, people not understanding each other. Or people saying, well, we voted for this government, but it's not taking good care of our interests. One of the things that both Hannah Arendt in her work on civil disobedience and Dewey said is democracy begins when people say, okay, we have voted for these people. They're doing things or they are not doing things. They're deliberating well or not, but they're not taking care of the issues that we care about. And that's when publics will form, people will get together, very practically. And Dewey talked about how the issue and the public that wants to discuss this issue constitute each other, which also means that if the issue at some point is resolved, that particular public will dissolve. So it's a very dynamic understanding of democracy. This is democracy as action. Rather than democracy in terms of deliberation or public reason or an aggregate of given preferences. This understanding of democracy called participative democracy has been further developed by, for instance, Chantal Mouffe, who talks about the importance of an agonistic debate. So instead of assuming that there's going to be consensus, let's be agonistic in a constructive way. So it's not about antagonism. You say A, so here comes me saying B. That's antagonism, that's for children. We have more to do in a democratic polity. This is about agonism. So the idea of Chantal Mouffe is that those who suffer the consequence or enjoy the consequences of, thank you, of certain policy decisions should get involved because we can learn from them. This is also Dewey and this is also Arendt. There is an interesting professor of science and technology, actually a Dutch professor, Ari Rip, on constructive technology assessment. So the idea is that before you put ready-made stuff on the market, while you are developing technologies, you sit down with the people who are going to suffer the consequences or enjoy them, and you listen to them, you let them work with it, you get their input. And again, he talks about the importance of agonism to get the best arguments, the most reliable technology. And this is actually similar to what Hannah Arendt says, that a public space, a really good institutionalized public space, should enable plurality, not consensus. Because if everybody looks the same way and it's the wrong way, we're all going to. This is also about critical infrastructure. So, to sum up, democratic theory, governments owe their constituents equal concern and respect. Ronald Dworkin said this. This leads to two things: democracy, one person, one vote, rule of law, protecting the individual against the majority that will rule based on these votes. And that brings us to a very specific understanding of democracy as a system where the majority rules, but in such a way that minorities can become majority. That's an enormous challenge. So I'm not talking about minorities in the sense of women or handicapped people or black people. I'm talking about minority of opinion. So how to rule in such a way that there is real dynamism and society learns. Well, that means that democracy requires hard work, institutions, habits, vital civil society to enable action, plurality, natality, agonism. So the question that for me is core to this talk is how to reinvent and sustain a public sphere in the era of behavioral micro-targeting. So let's quickly go to political micro-targeting. And there's a lot of literature, empirical, analytical. I'm taking one wonderful example from colleagues, partly from the Netherlands, where they differentiate between promises and threats, on one hand for citizens, on the other for political parties, and then for public opinion. Very balanced. Threats, promise, fantastic. When you look at what I marked yellow, there is one very important something that they put under threat to public opinion, fragmentation of the marketplace of ideas. Just that term, marketplace of ideas. We're now in the realm of behaviorism. Is it interesting to talk about a marketplace of ideas? Is that what it is? I do think that this is core to what is happening, a fragmentation of a shared public space. So I would articulate it differently. And that doesn't only affect public opinion, of course, but also political parties, if there is still such a thing 10 years from now, and also citizens. How we understand citizens now, is that going to be there 10 years from now? So I want to go a little deeper and look at what is this micro-targeting? What are we talking about? Here we have a tweet from somebody who worked on the YouTube algorithm, and he says that the algorithm that he worked on heavily promoted Brexit because divisiveness is efficient for watch time, and watch time leads to ads. Brits deserve, he's so excited, he begins to stammer on Twitter, to know what YouTube's AI promoted by the millions. Without transparency, there is no democracy. Okay, so let's go back a step, not start with political micro-targeting, but with commercial micro-targeting. The advertising model of free services, how does it work? Well, you begin by capturing behavioral data. For instance, real-time bidding. And I'm going to come back to that because I'm very curious how many of you know that yesterday complaints were filed with the supervisory authority in the UK and Ireland saying that this whole system, based on the fact that when I visit a website, that a whole set of personal data, amongst which potentially sensitive data, is sent by the ad tech, advertising tech company, to an enormous amount of companies who are invited to bid. And these complaints say that is a violation of the GDPR. If this is no longer allowed, if the court in Luxembourg comes to decide on this and says this is indeed a violation of the GDPR, and I think there's no doubt about that, then the whole system of advertising bidding is going to end. And this particular business model will have to change. Yes, I hear. Okay. So after capturing all these data, we have to figure out the ground truth. That's a term that machine learners use. So you get all this data, you get all sorts of features, age, location, what sort of device do people use, etc., etc. And now you want to connect that with on what sort of ads people actually click and what sort of stuff they actually buy. So you want to know their preferences. That is your ground truth that you have to test. And if you have that and you can connect it with all these different features of people, then the idea is that you can micro-target them. So you're matching features in the sense of age, gender, political preference, etc., with consumer preferences that are interesting for the company who is selling these ads. And then you're going to sell targeted ad space in auctions based on inferred relevance. And that may be paid per impression. So when I go to a website where there is a certain advertisement that I never click on, I don't even look at it, it might be that the advertiser has to pay for that. that's pay per impression. It might also be that the advertiser only has to pay if I click on it. That's pay per click. Might also be if the advertiser only has to pay if I actually, within the next 2-3 days, go and buy something. That's called pay per conversion. Now, everybody tells me that this works. And every talk I have about this subject, I say it doesn't really work. And then people come to me before and after in questions, and they say, how can you say that? Everybody's doing it. I'm sure it works because you can see it as a company that you get people who have clicked on your ad. So if that were true, why did Procter & Gamble, not a small company, last year decide to cut its digital ad budget, basically saying, literally saying, it doesn't do anything for us. We have left it and we've not seen less sales at all. Think of the prestidigitators. Where is the money going? Just look, follow the money. So what is the incentive created by this ecosystem? Maximizing user engagement. Maximizing the amount of time spent on a platform. What is the result? The result is to prioritize a specific type of content, for instance news, that promotes user engagement. This also means that the influence of super posters, that's a small, very small group of people that are posting all the time, very radical stuff, becomes very important. It's not very difficult to understand, actually. So the indirect effect is a selection for addictive content. There's enormous dynamics, there's enormous turbulence, there is a sort of a natural move towards extreme and sensational stuff available from these super posters. Whether something is fake or not fake, for the algorithm that is trying to figure out which content will bring the most revenue from advertiser, the algorithm is not interested in that. Of course, the companies are now, because we're all complaining about what it does to democracy. So now you see that all these big tech platforms are involved heavily in moderation. There's even people who say that's their main task now. And when you look at the numbers, maybe it's true. So how does this model of political micro-targeting work? Well, you capture behavioral data, you figure out the ground truth, and you start matching, but now with political preference. What is the deliberate, the express objective of political micro-targeting? Okay, maybe it's elections. Right? It's not just about votes. Right? It's not just about obtaining vote. It's much more distributed. It's to inform, disinform in a targeted way. It's to persuade or to dissuade people from voting. And it's to persuade or dissuade people from donating. This is very important dynamics in elections. Perhaps more so in the United States because of the legal system than with us. Just touching upon this, I'm not going into it, but similar things happen when governments, when they're governing, the administration is going to use these sort of techniques to micro-target their citizens. They can use that to inform their citizens. But sometimes maybe it's handy to use it to not inform your citizens because you can get on with your job. There is a famous professor in the United States who writes a lot in a newspaper. She's very outspoken, who basically has been saying for quite a long time, 2012, I think her first opinion in the New York Times appeared, that what this micro-targeting achieves in the end, even if not meant to achieve that, is to paralyze and polarize. Howard William Kahlo, who wrote one of the key texts on this subject, say, well, it's not really about trying to change voter opinion. It's also about attacking journalists, discrediting political leaders, and amplifying negative messaging. And again, another text, a very important point made, there is a change of institutions in our what we would have called public sphere. We're moving towards online media platforms. Data brokers play a very important role. Technology providers and analytic companies, totally new players in the field. And we're not at all equipped to deal with that, also legally speaking. Also, this is about artificial intelligence in the simple sense that you can use small pieces of software and send them out to do certain work for you as agents, artificial agents on the web with very defined goals. They can navigate around the web, they can try to influence behavior and make environments unpredictable. So even if they do not achieve what they want to achieve, what the term micro-targeting suggests, some sort of surgical influence, maybe that's not what's happening. But what is happening is confusion, fragmentation. People become afraid. And of course, you can use bots for that and bot networks, which exponentially increase the impact that you have. Distraction. So if something very important happens politically here and you don't want people to be involved in that, you can distract them this way. Confusion, fragmentation, radicalization. Now, it's important to look at the deliberate effects and the indirect effects. So we can have more informed publics, is possible, if you do it well, less informed. So the question that we have to ask and think about is the redistribution of informed and disinformed. How is this redistribution happening? How can we bend it back? Is Europe better than that, than the United States, due to the system, the different systems? Erosion of the public sphere. So if everybody is in her own echo chamber, many people have written about this. Cass Sunstein wrote about it in 2001. Pariser, who was part of the Obama campaign team, wrote the famous book, The Filter Bubble. So this awareness that this is happening, fragmentation, people not hearing each other anymore, this awareness has been around. So proliferation of extreme content, distraction, confusion. A colleague of mine said to me, you know why people vote for Trump? Well, they say Trump is a liar, but at least he's honest about it. And I thought, wow, he's nailing it, in an indirect sense, of course. So if you confuse people totally and completely, and they don't trust anybody anymore, then they might begin to trust people of whom they know that he's lying. Yeah, but at least he's, well, whatever. You know, he's a good actor or whatever. Or is he? So this micro-targeting basically creates a scalable subject. There's a wonderful article about this. A scalable citizen. That means you're no longer interested in people of flesh and blood. Come on, who's interested in real people? Totally boring and manipulable. So besides that, you can't control them. But you can control the scalable subject, the data points. They can be nudged. Nudge theory, behavioral economics, cognitive psychology. I think it all doesn't work. It all doesn't work. But as long as people believe that it works, decisions are going to be taken. So what happens is you're going to govern data set subjects instead of people. That's very problematic. And of course, all sorts of defenses that you can think of, this is just one, and this is all happening. It's also one of the reasons why it's never going to work, because we are so clever. But you can also be a bit more systematic about this. There's an article out about POTS, protective optimization techniques that are using machine learning and sort of tweaking it. Okay, this is what I already explained to you. So some people have now filed complaints yesterday about the real-time bidding system. Let's see what happens. What is the direction that I see? First of all, agonistic machine learning. Involve those who are going to be affected in the search design. Now, somebody might say to me, when I go and drive a car, nobody asks me to be involved in the research design of that car, right? I will see whether it works or not. Agreed. But if we're going to use these technologies to influence elections, to nudge us into certain choices, actually to create and sustain a choice architecture capable of manipulating us, even paternalistically, to do good for us, right? Then we want to be involved, right? That's very different from the car. Each research design choice in machine learning, what data you are using, how you are curating it, what synthetic data you are adding, what feature space you are using, what hypothesis space you are using, each decision that you make, and many of these decisions are made on very practical grounds. We don't have money for other data, so let's use these low-hanging fruit. Each decision has trade-offs in terms of liability, reliability, fairness, and, of course, risk redistribution. In that process of agonistic machine learning, we need to also answer three questions every time. I wish every policy document, white paper, report from commissions, so and so of the government, I wish everyone asked just these three questions. What problem are you solving? Or did you have a technology and you're looking for a problem? We all know that it works like that. Why don't we draw the conclusion? I want to know what problem you're solving. And if there is no problem, then go do your homework and come back. This also depends on the alternatives. The alternative might be the status quo, and it might be very bad. So it might be very important to come up with new ways of doing things. But very often, there are six or seven new ways of doing things, three of which are three different ways of building machine learning applications. Always ask the question, what problem is not solved? Maybe the real problem is not solved, but some invented problem is solved. Trade-offs are always there, so face the fact that your solution will create other problems, and it might be bigger. Then, I think, because of all the problems around behavioral advertising, micro-targeting, because it fundamentally doesn't work, look at Procter & Gamble, and it's not the only one. I think it's very important that here in Europe we now have this GDPR, which by some people is seen as an obstruction to innovation. I think innovation is in Europe is going to be saved by the GDPR, because we will be forced to be far more creative, far more efficient, and far more effective than if you can just get all the data in. The more data you put together, the more spurious patterns you get, the more security problems you're going to have. And these can be extremely dangerous. We're also talking critical infrastructure. Data protection law has principles like purpose limitation and data minimization. Many people for years have laughed at me and said, she is so naive, this woman. Yeah. She's talking too long also. Purpose limitation doesn't work with big data, because that means you throw a lot of data on a heap and you send some algorithms and then you get enormous added value. Ask any data scientist, any computer scientist, absolute bollocks. It doesn't work like that. If you do not know what you want to know from that data, you can't achieve anything. Okay, the last thing, rethink competition law. At this moment, competition law is focused on lowering consumer price, and the idea when something is free is that it has a very low price, while actually paying with your data means we're in the realm of excessive pricing. Excessive pricing is a legal term out of competition law. Think monopsonies, concentration on the buyer's end. Think Uber, that is able to rip up the labor market by forcing people to not be employees, but something else, because of the concentration of power that creates all sorts of problems, which we call monopsonies, because buyer's market. And remember, very simple, there is no such thing as a free lunch. So the free business model, we are seeing it now, is creating havoc, not only in sense of failed markets, but also in the sense of democracy. And that's what I want to talk about here. And this is obviously the end, yes.
Let's see whether this works. It works. Thank you, Mirai, for this very extremely engaging and sharp lecture. I like the fact how you moved from democratic theory, which kind of made me think about my political theory courses when I studied political science, and kind of connected so clearly and so nicely to current developments in political micro-targeting. I learned a lot, which is good news, maybe or maybe not. What we're going to do is we still have some time left for questions. We have two mics, and if I'm correct, there will be two people who will walk around with those. And I would like indeed to ask both Lina and Mirai to stand for a little bit longer, because this is the only mic that also works. So you have to share that one and have to do with those. I'm going to ask the audience. To every one of you, do you have any questions? Please be so kind to formulate them shortly. Please make sure that you end with a question mark, so it's not going to be an argument, but a question. And also, before you raise your question, please tell us your name, if that's possible. Who wants to kick off? There, on the side there. Yes.
My name is Dick van Elk. I've been working for IBM in the mid-80s. I developed there the system which was the predecessor of the internet. The intranet for customers. Before that, we had an intranet for technical stuff. If I make an analysis of what went wrong, it's a different one. What went wrong is we are followers. We have become followers, and our institutions, especially our governments, are followers. What we need to do is recapture the information technology, because it's a simple technology. It's a real simple technology. If you know how it works, you can easily, with only a couple of million euros, change the system. But that means that we have to go in another way. And
are we going to get a question
no,
mark?
Yeah.
Because we don't have that much time, so
I was just starting my real question. Do you think that there is a possibility to generate a new internet from another perspective than the old one?
And to whom are you addressing the question in the first place?
I don't care.
Okay.
I'm interested in the answer.
Lena, do you want to give it a go?
If you're just interested in the answer, then ask Google. They have answers to all the questions already computed. Recreating the internet, of course, is a holy grail what everybody is doing nowadays. The most successful has been so far North Korea, followed by China. They have been really able to recreate the internet using the same protocol. However, I had in my life luck to be in MIT at the moment when Bill Clinton was giving a speech just days before leaving his post finally. And in front of the students, he said that what you are doing right now, it takes 5 years before it gets to the business and entrepreneurs. And then it takes 5 years before it goes to the Congress. And this is something which we will be facing as a biggest challenge, that MIT, this university, researchers around the world are working with things which eventually will face and hit Congress, parliaments around the world, regulators. And what Bill Clinton said is that whatever you are doing, know that first reaction from Congress will be to stop it. What you can and what you should do is to explain it. And this is really what you did today, what we are trying to do around the world every day, to explain to the lawmakers that what is under research right now and what are the new technologies which will emerge to the market need already in the research phase to be starting to start blinking on the radar screens of the lawmakers.
Yes, I'm not entirely sure I understand the question, so I'll just add one remark to what you said. I think that the whole concept of markets is up for grabs now, so some people seem to think that a market is something that you can grow in a garden, that it's natural or organic, that it's, there's just out there a market. Markets are artificial constructions. Markets are constructed by private law. Private property, contract, tort, added with consumer protection, unfair trade practices and competition law. That is how a market is created. And it seems that at this moment we have market failure all over the place, but we don't see it. And I'm not saying that in the sense that we don't want to see it. Definitely there are people who don't want to see it. But it's not that simple how we have to mend that. There's a famous article that came out last year from Lina Khan in the Yale or Harvard Law Journal, where she analyzed what happened to competition law and what happened in focusing entirely on consumer price and how that skewed the law, so the construction of markets. So we have to do the work in terms of Hannah Arendt. To get to the action, we have to do the hard work of creating the system that enables people to flourish and to speak freely, and definitely not to be only treated as numbers. I'm not against treating people like numbers.
But not all the time.
But not only, never only. That's Kant. Eh?
Yeah, that's different. Yeah. Who can I give the floor for another question?
My name is Herman Walter. I should like to know, you have a personal secured identity for natural persons. Do you have also an identity, secured identity for legal persons? That would make possible a lot of transactions.
Legal persons are artifacts or creations as markets, created by individuals. So behind every legal body, NGO, foundation, microbusiness, enterprise, there is a governing body which is constituted of people. So in our case, it's very clear, all the security measures needed to represent or to have on the corporate level are the same as on the individual level. So in short, yes, the answer is yes. The legal bodies need to be, as in a similar way, interoperable with a strong security environment as we are using for individuals.
Do they have a passport also, the corporation? I have a transaction with a corporation. He asked me my personal identity.
It's your personal, of course. in your role. In your role as a CEO of the company, you represent the company. As a client, you represent yourself as a customer of that particular company. And the relation between you and the company will be similarly built up as any other relationship. So it ends up with an individuals having a digital identity, and they can have a different role. Prime Minister is an individual of Estonia. In the role of Prime Minister right now, if he will be kicked off from the office, he's no longer in the role of Prime Minister. Somebody else is taking that role. But he remains as a father, and he remains as a member of an NGO, and he remains as a vice chair of the church he belongs, and so on and so on. So you can have multiple roles, which are all supported with your single individual identity. And this is the biggest difference between a number of other countries, where people have different identities in different roles. This is an chaos. Prime ministers can't have a prime minister identity, or CEO of Royal Dutch Shell can't have a kind of CEO identity. Individuals need to have one identity, but multiple roles.
There's someone there in the relatively in the back who wants to ask a question.
Thank you. My name is Bram de Rijk. I had a question for Professor Hildebrand. In your explanation of democratic theory, you touched upon the idea of participation as a sort of counterforce that people can organize themselves if they feel that the other institutions fail. Yet you also explain then that they that due to the internet and the maybe the long tail concept, people tend to find themselves or people with similar opinions and create echo chambers. So then would you say that the concept of participatory society that's been endemic for the last decade in many Western societies, or at least the Netherlands, actually exacerbates the problems that we see nowadays because it just tells people to participate, but then they participate within their own filter bubble into the idea of camp thinking, more or less?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question, because if you think in terms of behaviors, and that is how these chambers are operational, that's what makes them tick. So people are driven together in these echo chambers and their behavior develops. We all know probably the concept of threshold behavior. So if 10 people do something, nobody listens, 100 also not. But there is some point where suddenly other people are going to do the same thing. That's herd behavior, and there's a lot of research into that part of cognitive psychology, behavioral economics, etc. And the big tech companies have the data to research that. Now, what interests me is not this behaviorist attitude. Actually, I am worried that we mistake that sort of interaction for participation in the sense of action. So this difference, this conceptual difference between action and behaviorism is crucial, and it's not easy to explain, because maybe when you explain action, somebody will hear you explaining a behavior and say, well, what is she talking about? But it's a crucial difference, because the behavior makes you, to some extent, manipulable. I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with that. A government has a lot to do, so it has to have some idea of its citizens. But if the government retreats from the idea that citizens have agency, however little, we should not exaggerate our agency, and retreats from protecting, nourishing that agency, then we have a very big problem. And I think that sort of participation is behavior-based, is, let's say, data-driven, and we have to rethink how to get a step further. We can't go back. There's no going back. So we have to go a step further and tweak that sort of stuff in such a way that we can play around with it. I'm not talking about gaming the system. Sometimes that must be done. But playing around in the sense of developing your own agency and getting together with people.
Thank you. We have room for a final question, if there is any. There's one there.
Yes, Yes, hello. My name is Wessel, and I'm working for the Ministry of Health. A few days ago, the copyright directive passed in the European Parliament. The directive will inhibit certain flows of information, and some critics call it for danger to democracy. Do you have any strong opinions about the EU directive?
Not too strong. We have seen also earlier a number of directives which are a result of political compromises and which will be not welcomed by the member states on an equal level. There is already a number of member states who are reserving the rights to have different implementation practices towards that particular directive. I'm not sure whether the kind of it's a last process of the present European Commission and Jean-Claude Juncker's attempts to deliver the last final steps. That will not be directive of what he will be remembered of, and there is a strong risk that it will not play a significant role at all. We need to put many of those directives also, especially what deal with the digital matters, and one might say everything has a digital aspect nowadays. Also, the GDPR, which was also referred by my co-speaker, we don't know how it works out on a global scenario. The scenarios are very different. One scenario, of course, is that everybody will ignore it. We are only 500 million market construction. We are so small. We are irrelevant. And nobody in India, China, Africa cares what Europe is doing with its directives or not doing. And the real dominant markets or behaviors, the rules, are coming from the different regions, and we can remain isolated, or we can be ignored, or there is also a scenario and opportunity that we are leading the way. We are examples. But that requires actions beyond directives and actions towards kind of constructive solutions. The payment service directives or the financial market regulations have not been followed with appropriate actions to be a leading showcase and example for the rest of the world. And we don't have right now, honestly, any reason to believe that this particular directive would be different from the others.
Okay. With that, no, I'm very sorry. We're already 10 minutes over time, and the organizers told me that I was not allowed to go a single minute over time. So we already kind of stretched it a bit. Exactly. This is civil disobedience. I don't know whether that's behavior or action. I'm not. You could tell, Radar. Or it's both. So I think that the Q&A actually showed the breadth of the topic as well, kind of moving from the difference between action and behavioral to the last laws that or the regulations that are actually passed in the European Parliament. But I think that we've got a lot of insights from these two speakers, and I want to kind of thank both of them for their engaging way of bringing their experience and their ideas to us. So thank you for that. Both of you, I think they deserve another round of applause for that. They might be staying here for a couple of minutes, so if you have any personal questions, you might try to reach them. I also want to thank, before you all stand up, I want to thank the organizers. There are actually a cooperation of three organizations who actually organized this lecture. The Europe Lecture Foundation, the Montesquieu Institute, and that all part of the Prinsjesfestival. So thank you all for being here, and I hope you have a good evening as well. Thank you.